On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
Topic of Confederate monuments has become very controversial in America today, and with good reason. One side says these monuments represent American history. The other side says they represent American history when our people were enslaved, and we don't like the reminders of that. There are some people that are in the middle, and then there are the historians who look at it and say, here's what we know about the monuments, here's what we think about the monuments. There was an excellent article in one of the numerous magazines that I read about a year ago, and one of the people that was mentioned in that article was our guest today, Dr. Karen Cox, whose new book is No Common Ground, Confederate Monuments and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice. It's from the University of North Carolina Press. Karen is professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. Her other books include Dreaming of Dixie, How the South Was Created in American Popular Culture, and Dixie's Daughters, The United Daughters of the Confederacy and the Preservation of Confederate Culture, both of which I've had an opportunity to review. Thank you for making time to talk to us on the Bookshelf.
Oh, I'm happy to do that, especially with a host in the South.
On the way in this morning, I walked past our little Confederate memorial that's on the square. Courthouse moved from the square back in the 1950s, but the little monument is on one corner, and there's a World War I monument on another corner. Pretty typical scenario in most towns across the South, and certainly in the major cities as well. And they have become very controversial. I suppose, to be fair, within the African-American community, they've always been controversial.
That's true. It's absolutely true. I think some people think that this has only emerged since the Black Lives Matter movement was founded in 2014, but it goes back as long as there have been Confederate monuments. African Americans have long felt discomfort with these statues in their communities, have also critiqued them and fronted them in different ways.
Now, there's really two historical aspects of the monuments that very, very important. One is the lost cause mythology that developed soon after the Civil War ended. And the other is related to that, and that is, according to your research, the most powerful women's organization in America, or at least in the southern part of the United States, post-Civil War, and that was the United Daughters of the Confederacy.
Yes, so the lost cause is really critical to understanding the context around Confederate monuments. And the United Daughters of the Confederacy actually will be the second generation of southern white women to memorialize the Confederacy, but the UDC is really the organization, and I think one of the most, it was definitely the most influential in the South. That organization of women is the group primarily responsible for the vast majority of Confederate monuments on the Southern landscape.
This lost cause idea that the South lost because we were outmanned, not outgeneraled, that we were just overwhelmed by superior forces, that the Southern cause was a noble one, and so forth. And this was backed up by literature and speeches by former Confederate soldiers, veterans, and by those who had been married to men who had served in the Civil War. The North seems to have bought into that at some point as well. It maybe as a matter of reconciliation. There are lots of possible reasons for that. I can see why the South would want to embrace this, the idea that it was a noble cause and so forth, but why did Northern states or veterans of the Union Army seem to embrace this idea as well?
The white South embraced it, certainly not the members, not the blacks. And white Northerners, I think there are a variety of reasons that they would not necessarily embrace the lost cause, but turn a blind eye to it and just kind of say, you know, accept it, that that's something that happens in the South and that's the way it is. But not only did veterans, Federal Army, want to reconcile with the South, the North wanted an economic relationship with the South again. They wanted to reestablish that. So it's about reestablishing all kinds of relationships, economic, political, social. As a matter of fact, Union veterans were the very first tourists to the South after the Civil War. They began coming back to visit the battlegrounds that they had fought on. And so that part of it, And also, I think just the ideas around reunification led people to just kind of say, okay, let's just get back to being, you know, the United States.
Right.
And, you know, whatever's happening down in the South, you know, that's their business. And they do turn a blind eye to it, and such a blind eye to it that there are Confederate monuments in the Northeast, in the Midwest, in California.
In the North, just because they freed the slaves doesn't mean that every Union soldier necessarily agreed that black people were equal to white people. This was the ongoing cultural battle of the Reconstruction, right?
Well, it's that, but it's also this. Look, the reality is the war may have been fought over slavery. Of course, the Lost Cause says it's always states' rights, but the war was fought over slavery. But that did not mean that white Americans anywhere believed in racial equality. There may be a few people who did, but they didn't really believe in that. As the 19th century wears on, there's the rise of an Anglo-Saxon movement focused on white supremacy, survival of the fittest, kind of that social Darwinism that emerges in the late 19th century that all Americans are sort of engaged in. And the 1890s in particular saw the rise of these, I would call them Anglo-Saxon heritage organizations. You had the Sons of the American Revolution, the Daughters of the American Revolution, as well as the UDC and the Sons of Confederate Veterans in the 1890s. This was a movement that was going on everywhere. And the thing that white Americans shared was their race and this belief in their supremacy.
I have friends who are in the Sons of Confederate Veterans, and they hold to the party line that it's not about white supremacy, it's about Southern heritage. And I think to a certain extent it is. No one wants to say, my great-grandfather died fighting to maintain slavery when he had a little dirt farm and owned no slaves, because it just seems not only politically incorrect, it just seems stupid.
Right.
And nobody wants to say, you know, my great-great-grandfather limped home from the war without a leg and an arm because he didn't want black people to be equal to white people.
First, I want to just respond to this idea of Southern heritage. Implicit in that is white heritage.
Right.
They're not talking about black Southerners here. And this is the thing that I think people need to acknowledge, is that African Americans are every much that have lived in the South are as much of a Southerner as I am. When you say Southern heritage, you're in reference to monuments. You're talking about a very particular heritage.
Right.
Response on the other, you're right. No one wants to accept the idea that their ancestor had fought in a war to perpetuate slavery. They may not have owned slaves, and there may have been class conflicts, you know, and there were class conflicts about the Civil War. But the reality is that ordinances of secession say it's about slavery,
right,
across the South, and so does, you know, Alexander Stevens, the vice president of the Confederacy, in his cornerstone speech, which is to say that the cornerstone of the Confederacy is founded on the belief that the white man is superior to the quote-unquote Negro. Slaveryism is very much part of what the Confederacy was about, and you just can't get away from that. Whether or not an individual soldier read those documents, or they had to know that this is their leadership was saying as much. I have a Confederate ancestor, and I can say that doesn't mean that I can't question or acknowledge the fact that this war was about slavery.
We're talking to Dr. Karen Cox, who is the author of No Common Ground, Confederate Monuments and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice. It's from the University of North Carolina Press. Ironic thing is that right after the Civil War, and Robert E. Lee only lived 5 years after the war, but for most of those 5 years, he was very much a reconciler. That is to say, he wanted people to not be bitter toward each other. He wanted people to forget that there had been such armed enmity between the two halves of the country, and that we should be all Americans again. And yet, he is probably the most popular person to be iconicized by being turned into a statue of all the Confederate leaders, even more so than Jefferson Davis. There certainly is an irony in that.
Well, right. he didn't think that the South should be engaging in monument building at all, thought that this was not a good idea, that we should work on healing and reconciliation, like you said. But the fact of the matter is this: the Lost Cause was bigger than Robert E. Lee. It didn't matter what he thought, in a way, right? Yeah. This was going to happen with or without him. And who knows how he would have thought about this 20 years later, if he had survived. We don't know, but we only know that part. He's the most memorialized of all the Confederate generals, and of course, the apex of that is the monument, Monument Avenue in Richmond, Virginia, to him, that was unveiled in 1890, that enormous equestrian statue right. of him. And it's just, he, for white Southerners, especially white men, he represents the ideal of Confederate leadership, of military leadership, of this noble Christian warrior. He embodies all of that, and it's done in such a way that slavery just is almost not even a part of any of it. It's all stripped. His reputation is stripped of that, of the realities of slavery, and stripped of the realities of defeat. Because the Lost Cause is all about this was a just cause and a sacred cause. And for white Southerners, Lee represents that. And he also represents this sort of reestablishment of white masculinity and Southern masculinity in the aftermath of defeat. Because white veterans, of course, were emasculated by what had happened. The Lost Cause was almost, in some ways, necessary to the white South if they were going to overcome that.
Black newspapers during the Reconstruction era and in the early 20th century were not shy about saying that the monuments were offensive to them and a reminder of terrible days and so forth. But unfortunately, black press was pretty much ignored in America, except among African Americans, until, I guess, the 1950s or so.
Leaders like Frederick Douglass were quick to call them monuments of folly. He was the leading black intellectual of the 19th century, and the leading black intellectual of the 20th century, W.E.B. Du Bois, said a better inscription on these monuments were that these men fought to perpetuate human slavery. But it was the average person. It were black Southerners that were most affected by this. And John Mitchell, Jr., who was the editor of the Richmond Planet, the black newspaper in Richmond, and he wrote a lot about the Lee Monument unveiling there in 1890 and why, you know, this was problematic. And he saw the writing on the wall, which was that it accompanied the political efforts to dial back Reconstruction. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, in black newspapers, you know, especially in the, I write about the Chicago Defender, which was a national black newspaper that many black Southerners read and circulated. You know, someone in the community might have a copy and they would be passed around, for example. And so in that paper, black Southerners like registered their contempt for these monuments and said, why are we honoring men who were traitors to the United States, who took up arms against the United States? And so they were very clear about it, about their dislike for these monuments and what they felt that they meant. And having those statues on the grounds of courthouses, sending out a signal to black citizens that you're actually second-class citizens. Mm-hmm. And the people inside that courthouse, which are white men, are the one who control government and, you know, movement of black people, especially at state legislatures, where they're basically legalizing Jim Crow across the South. So monuments to them are kind of represent that. And that's why I don't believe that monuments, while they stand firmly on a piece of ground, are static. They send messages. And on one hand, it might be a message to people who say, oh, this is about my Confederate ancestry. On the other hand, you know, for black Southerners, this is about people who fought in a war that would have ensured their ancestors remain enslaved. Hmm. And so that's why there's no common ground. It's no common ground in what they think they're about, and it's not common ground when these statues are placed on the courthouse or in the town square, because it's supposed to be public, it's supposed to be democratic space, but the space has become divisive because of those statues.
The majority of these statues, and I was amazed to read how many of them there were, an enormous number of statues that were erected kind of in the heyday of the UDC, the 1890s and the early part of the 20th century, right?
That's right. That's right. I think the peak period may have been in like 1910, 11, and there were something like, in that period, the vast majority were built. But in that, I think in 1910 or 11, there were four monuments going up every single month.
So what do we do with these things? You make a distinction between monuments that are on Civil War battlefields and monuments that are in public squares. And I agree with that difference, that a memorial was put up at Gettysburg or Shiloh, which I visited, does not seem out of place because this is where those people died. It's a different thing to have it on the square where it continues to be a reminder of days gone by.
Right. There is that difference. I think in national parks or these battlefields, you have historians there, you know, who can talk about what these statues meant and when they went up and provide some more context. And which, you know, on the courthouse lawn or in, you know, the town square, there is no context. Nothing there to provide the context. That's part of what makes them different. Also, the fact that if they're on public ground or government-owned property, that means that the local government is paying to maintain that with your taxes. So if you're an African-American, why would you want to help do that?
So is the appropriate thing to do to move them to museums? There are certainly museums that grounds where they could be put in there. And once again, you'd have the same situation where historians would be on hand and can say, you know, this is the context of this statue in its original setting. And that seems like a way of mollifying those who say, well, if you destroy a statue, no matter what the statue is of, you're destroying art, and say, well, if we move it to a museum, then that ceases to be the issue. And you pay to go to a museum on purpose to see things, it's there. Or is that...
There's a lot in what you said there, because I think that, first of all, let's just take it, not all of them are pieces of art. Some of these, they were just cookie-cutter monuments that you ordered out of a catalog. The other thing is that museums have collections policies, and they're not necessarily in the business of collecting Confederate monuments. They may or may, let's say they do have the grounds for it, you know, then it becomes the hot potato that they have to deal with. Because then if it's moved to those grounds, and let's say the museum is sponsored, co-sponsored by, you know, gets part of its budget from the city or county government, then it becomes another issue of, oh, you're maintaining that, this object, this divisive object. Yes, one might put context around it, but here's the problem. There is like a panel, that a 4 foot by 6 foot panel with some writing on it, standing, you know, sitting on the ground adjacent to a monument that may be 30 feet tall. There's an optics problem there. You still have, like, here's the dominant narrative standing at 30 feet tall, and here's our counter narrative on this 4 by 6 foot panel or something. You know, that's problematic. There's been the ways in which communities are going to deal with these, if they deal with them at all, because right now monument laws prevent taking away local control in, right, in many of these situations. Is that, you know, like I've seen, there was one here in Salisbury, North Carolina, that was moved to the Confederate cemetery. Some UDC chapters have taken a monument back, and they may end up on private property. That's another option. Whether or not it goes to a museum, that's, you know, that's a lot for, you know, that's like it's still part of the community,
right,
and it could be problematic there too. So there's, like I said, doesn't mean that they're going to be destroyed, but, you know, I think what's going to happen, if local communities were actually allowed to do what as they wish with the Confederate monuments, you might see a variety of very creative solutions to it. But the way in which state legislatures across the South have written these monument laws, or also known as Heritage Protection Acts, they have taken away local control. And so what you see now is, rather than a local community being able to do something, or communities wish to have a monument removed, there's no legal recourse. I mean, they're going to be, I think they will be in litigation, and there are communities that are filing lawsuits along these lines. But these laws, instead of actually protecting the monuments, actually lead to them being vandalized. The very first monument law was in 2000, South Carolina, and it had to do with the removal, the boycott, NAACP boycott of the battle flag on top of the Capitol ground,
right,
building. and it was removed, and then in that legislation they made the battle flag a monument. But the real reality isn't in, it wasn't in response necessarily to these protests, but it was in response in 2015 and after the Charleston massacre. After the Charleston massacre, and that when South Carolina removed the battle flag from the grounds of the state capitol, this signaled to people that, oh, they're coming for the monuments next. And so that's actually when the monument laws began being passed. North Carolina, where I live, passed one of the first ones 1 month after the Charleston massacre. Like, it's not necessarily in reaction to the protest, although now, I think more recently, I think yes. And it's become a wedge issue.
So contrary to popular narrative, the first Confederate monument to be moved was actually from about 120 miles from here in Selma, Alabama, a hotbed controversy over the Confederate monuments and the civil rights movement.
Very true. I mean, I think when Mitch Landrieu in New Orleans gave his big speech and it was widely read and circulated, and he led the movement to remove monuments in New Orleans, the narrative out there was that New Orleans was the first city to remove a monument, you know, from the public square.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out it was actually Selma, Alabama in 2000 when a group had placed a monument to Nathan Bedford Forrest, the first Grand Dragon.
Right.
They had placed a monument on public property, in the city of Selma. And Selma, which in 2000 had its first black mayor, the first time that the city council was a black majority, and they said, no, you know, this is not going to happen, and you're going to have to move the monument.
Yeah.
And if you don't, we'll move it for you. So it ends up that then that monument is moved to the Confederate section of a cemetery, a public cemetery. But
right.
it is Selma, not New Orleans. And but people didn't know about it, of course, because we were in the midst of a lot of the events of the last 5 years, and so the focus was on New Orleans. But one,
right.
To my surprise in doing my research, it was actually Selma.
This is not the end goal, removing these from the public square. What do you think has to follow the removal of Confederate monuments from the public square?
Well, I think there needs to be some truth and reconciliation around the issue of race in our nation, you know, and particularly in our region, from slavery to Jim Crow to, you know, mass incarceration. I mean, there's this long history of this and a refusal to acknowledge it. And I think, you know, that there has to be some healing around the issue on race. And I do think there are people of goodwill who are out there who see it that way. I mean, I've been talking to people of faith on this issue. I'm not just talking to academics, and I'm talking to people of faith and who really do see it this way. So I think that's encouraging.
Our guest today has been Dr. Karen Cox. Her book, No Common Ground, Confederate Monuments and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice, a Ferris and Ferris book published by the University of North Carolina Press. Karen, I know they can go to uncpress.org and find out more about their publications, which includes your book, but do you have a website also?
Karen Cox Historian, all one phrase, .com.
Okay.
Karen Cox Historian.com.
Okay, easy enough. Karen, it's been a very interesting discussion, and I think this is one that more people need to have around the South, certainly, but around the country, and sit and have a cup of coffee and talk. I think that's been sadly lacking in all of this. So.
I agree with you about that very much. I think just breaking bread and sitting down and having a civil conversation, we could get a lot further along.
Thank you very much for the book and for making time to talk to us today.
Happy to do it. Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us on The Bookshelf. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.